Accession number 28709, Reel 3.
This is Bunty Lawson, Reel 3.
When my posting overseas came through, what I was really aiming for was to get out to India. But the WAFs didn't seem to be sent out to India at that point. And with the list of uniforms, I was sent then on embarkation leave, having had various jabs of, I don't know what, TNT and cholera. No, we didn't have cholera. We have a whole list of things, vaccination, the whole lot. And I felt absolutely ghastly on my travel home. I went back by train, well, sea and then train. And I was still in my sleeper in bed when we pulled into London. So I can remember walking up the station, trying to tie my tie and climb into my skirt more or less at the same time. But I lived. And then we were given the princely sum of about, it was £8 or £9, I think, to help us towards the cost of our overseas uniform, which bought the tin trunk we had to have with our name painted on it, which I think I got mine at Moss Bros. And then it was something like 4 khaki shirts, 2 khaki tunics, 2 shirts, so many pairs of khaki stockings, and a pith helmet, a Bombay bowler. Well, you try and get a pith helmet from a Bombay bowler in the middle of a war, in the middle of London. It seemed absolutely impossible. I had gone up to London, accompanied by a reluctant father with an even more reluctant checkbook, to buy these jolly things. We went from one military tailor to the next trying to find a pith helmet, sun helmet, and found one, I think, in the end. It was in Austin Reed's. And I can see my father now sitting at one of the little chairs which we had in those days alongside counters, absolutely mopping his eyes with crying with laughter at me in this topi. And I looked across the shop, and there was a very, very tall, very, very thin WAF officer trying one on as well. So she turned to me and she said, "Do you think you are going where I'm going?" And I said, "It looks rather like it, doesn't it?" So we introduced ourselves, and she was actually a Canadian, but she happened to be working in London where the war started, so she joined up straight away. And we got on well. She was very obviously a Canadian. She'd been working actually at Harrods, their advertising department, before the war, and all her family were in Canada, so she met both my parents there in Austin Reed, and we exchanged telephone numbers and addresses. She was stationed in Kenley and had a very rough time during the Battle of Britain. And then my mother said what she could try and get for us. She insisted on us having travelling irons. Wherever we were going by war, we were going to be frightfully well-pressed uniforms. She did. My mother was rather miraculous in those things. She did manage to find 2 travelling irons, sent one off to Kenley to Ruth, and I was given the other. Neither of us ever used them. But anyway, it was a good effort on her part. And then finally we were given our orders to go by train from whichever, King's Cross, I suppose, up to Blackpool, to the PDC, which stands for Personnel Dispatch Centre. We still weren't told where we were going. And the night before we left, Ruth phoned me up at home and said, "Are your parents going to see you off at the station tomorrow?" And I said, "Yes, they are. We're actually going up to London the night before for dinner." I think mostly because I was so terrified of missing that train that I was going to be on the spot. And she said, "Do you think I could borrow your family? Mine are all in Canada. And I have nobody to say goodbye to me." So I said, "Oh, be my guest." I said, "I've never seen anyone so thrilled as my father." So we all met on the station while there were hugs and kisses all round. And my mother, she was obviously older than I was. And my mother saying, look after my little girl, won't you? And she said, yes, I will write you a quarterly report on her behaviour, which, bless her heart, she did right up until I was married. Well, until I was engaged. Then she said, I'm not being responsible for this woman any longer. And we've remained friends ever since. I'm recording this in 2006. And Ruth and I are still good friends. She is now coming up to 95, I think. And mentally, she's still as bright as a button. She's crippled with arthritis. We've both kept in touch. At one time, she used to come over every year and spend 2 or 3 weeks in England with us. She had more friends in England than she really had in Canada by that time. And Ian and I, years ago, we spent 3 weeks in Canada with her. And I've been to see her, in the last 7 years. But it's amazing that we have still kept up. And we still pick up exactly where we left off in our friendship. Anyway, we arrived in Blackpool, and we were there, I can't remember exactly how long, it was certainly about 2 weeks.
And this was in the summer of 42, is it?
This was the summer of 42. And then we were told we were sailing the next day from Liverpool. In the meantime, I'd broken my ankle. That was in plaster. But I wasn't, I think I could have got out of going, but I wasn't going to at this point. So we arrived in Liverpool, and we were sailing on the Orcades, which had been an Orient Line, really luxury liner. And that was an extraordinary trip, really. I think there were about 15 or 17 of us WAFs. And it was an odd number, and there were about the same number of Wrens on board, the Women's Royal Naval Service. And I was actually put in with them, so I was the only WAF in a cabin full of Wrens, but they treated me quite nicely. Well, they couldn't do anything else because I only had one leg to walk on, which was very awkward for everybody, extremely, very awkward for me. And we were, the sleeping bit part of it was very crowded because we were six in what was had been a cabin for two. So it was a bit of a scrum, the whole thing. But there were two bunks one end, two bunks in the sort of passageway between the sleeping part and what used to be the living part of the suite. We had our own bathroom and loo. And we had our own pre-war steward that did the cabin for us. Ticked me off, goodness, because he found me going to bed with the wet hair. Your mother wouldn't like it, you know. And he used to, of course, we would batten down complete blackout. And he was to arrive and climb over my bunk every day to undo the porthole and say, lovely day, wakey, wakey, girls, lovely day for submarines, and cheerfully go away again. And we went off. It was quite a big convoy. I don't know how many ships. It must have been 12 at least, if not more. Went extraordinarily slowly, and we zigzagged out practically the middle of the Atlantic. And then we zigzagged in again, because we had an escort, to Freetown. Freetown was my very first overview of a foreign country. I mean, I'd been to Ireland over and over every day, every year we went to Ireland. My father was Irish. But this was my first. You see, people didn't travel a lot in the 30s. And this was my first view of a foreign country. And I was so disappointed. Freetown, as we sailed in, it was murky, it was raining, and it might as well have been Liverpool. It was better by the time we left the next day. And then we went with a much smaller convoy. We went down the coast. Some of the convoy went into Cape Town. And we were in the bit that went round to Durban. In Durban, we were met at the quayside by an opera singer who I think was quite a famous. She was known as the Lady in White. and of course with a microphone. She had a magnificent voice, and she stood on the key side singing patriotic songs. Oh, there wasn't a dry eye in the house, practically. I heard later on, but I don't know if it's true or not, that she was in fact a spy for the Germans, because she had a perfect view of every ship that came in and out and how many more or less counted the troops as they came on and off. And at Durban we were meant to transship to go up the Red Sea and on up to Egypt. Nobody told us, but it was really dawning on us that was where we were going. And we had 6 weeks in Durban. They kept saying there was no ship for us to trans onto. But personally, I think, and I have no official thing for this, it was during the Battle of El Alamein, and I think they were waiting to see if the Germans were advancing on Cairo or not before we were taken there. Because I understand, and again I'm not sure of my facts, that they landed Wrens in Singapore after Singapore had fallen. And I think that's why we had such a lovely long holiday in Durban. There was no blackout, obviously. We had things like fresh orange juice, which we hadn't seen for months and years on end. We were made very welcome by the locals. We were honorary members of the most glamorous and lovely country club. There were two nightclubs. There was the Cosmos and the Stardust. We spent practically every evening in the Stardust. We were not meant to ever go out of uniform, but wearing full evening dress, carrying a squash racket. At least the squash courts were lit at night, so nobody could prove we weren't going to play squash. And Durban races were the high spot of most of our lives. And mostly we did extremely well. Then at the end of 6 weeks, we were told we were to embark on the New Amsterdam the next day. And we were in the Federal Hotel, which is sort of in the middle of Durban, and it wasn't in those days a very nice hotel. I may be treading on somebody's toes here, but an awful lot of the officers that had been on the Orcades were on a lovely hotel called the Edward up on the seafront. So we felt very much like the poor relations at the Federal, and like a lot of town hotels, it was built around sort of two squares, so there was a well in the middle. Well, we were all so overcome that we didn't have to black out the curtains. We never bothered. Where again, we were crowded in the bedrooms, four to six to, I suppose, a room for two. And we came down to breakfast one morning with a huge box of, I think it was Black Magic chocolate on our breakfast table, which said, "We're sailing today, girls, but thank you for the evening floor show." And they were obviously, we were lit up in our room, and they were the other side of the well and could see straight into our bedroom. And we gazed around wondering who on earth had been playing Peeping Tom for about 6 weeks. And nobody was looking guilty, so we thought we'll never meet them again, so it really doesn't matter. Which was one of the funnier things that happened. And then the day before the morning we were due to sail, we had to pay our hotel bills up to date. And it was also Durban races, so I held back, and I went to Durban races with a chap called Chris, I can't remember his other name, who was a gambler. And we both lost, I think, on every race. So by the time the last race had come, we didn't have a penny piece to get a taxi back into town. Neither did we have a penny piece to go out anywhere to dinner that night. So we started to walk back, which was quite a long way back into the town. Fortunately, we were in uniform, where he was anyway. I can't remember if I was or not. No, I think I must have been, because I'd done my packing. And a car stopped, and it was a trainer and a jockey, and said, "Are you going back into town?" So we said, "Yes, but we're broke. We've lost on every race." They said, "Get in. We'll give you a lift." So we were taken back into Durban. I was dropped off at the Federal, and I presume Chris went off to the Edward. And there I was. Everybody else was out on farewell parties, about to eat a lone dinner in an empty dining room, feeling extremely...
This is Bunty Lawson continuing reel three.
Presuming this is a seamless join in talk, there I was, miserable and alone and full of self-pity. And there was a sort of whirlwind arrived in through the dining room door, and it was Chris shouting, "I've managed to borrow £5. Come on, let's go out and spend it." It's amazing that in those days you could have quite a decent night out for £5. So off we went straight away to the Stardust and spent the last evening in Durban there, along with everybody else. And the next morning we embarked on what was proved to be a hell ship, the New Amsterdam, which had been ploughing up and down the Red Sea since the beginning of the war, I think. We were crowded as hell. And the first evening we went down to dinner, instead of the lovely dining room that we'd had on the Orchides, with white tablecloths and champagne at practically every dinner. But you could pick out the ones who had been on the Orchides, because we dressed for dinner still, put on our collars and ties and tunics, went down to the bars of the ship at the most ghastly dining room. It was only to be seconded by the ghastly food. And then the OC troops came on board with an open-neck shirt and shorts, so that was the end of dressing for dinner. And it juddered from end to end. We had water on twice a day in the sort of corridor outside our cabin, where you filled up a thermos with cold water, and you didn't have any water in between at all. If you went up onto the deck, you had it juddered literally from end to end, and you had to stake a little claim somewhere, and you couldn't really even read in any comfort because your book jumped up and down with you the whole time, and it was pretty awful. Anyway, we juddered. We thought we would go straight up to the Red Sea. Not a bit of it. We went to Madagascar. And we called in at Diego Suarez. Well, if anyone, till I got there, if anyone had asked me where it was, I'd have said South America, but it's not. It's in Diego Suarez. And it's in Madagascar. And there we took on quite a lot of South Africans, all a bit angry because they thought they were going back to the Union, and they weren't. They were going on up to Egypt, which didn't please the majority of them one bit. They were terribly inadequate. On the Orchides, we had boat drill every day, so if we were ever torpedoed, we knew exactly where to go and what to do. It was absolutely pointless on the New Amsterdam because there weren't anything like the lifeboats for us, and every now and again along the deck there were little rafts. And then we found that the South Africans were drawing lots as to which of the wafts they would take onto the raft with them. Fortunately, it wasn't necessary. The troops were even in a worse position than we were, with food and their living quarters. I mean, it must have been hell. They were seemed to be in bunks, one above the other, like a bookcase, right up to the ceiling, and then there was only about 18 inches between the bunk and the ceiling. So I don't think they had much of a journey either. We dropped anchor off Aden, where we took a this was without a convoy at all. Already, we had no guard ship at all. Attached to us at Aden, we had one lone balloon. And I can remember looking out at the little bungalows built on the side of the, well, side of a volcano, sort of, really, of Aden, and wondered who the flip lived there. Little did I know that a few years later I'd be there with my husband and two children, which was a rather strange feeling when I went back there again. And they weren't nearly as small as those bungalows as they looked from the harbour mouth. Anyway, we chugged on then up the Red Sea and we docked at Port Tewfik. And we were kept on board in the blazing sun in our full uniform, with a water bottle slung over one shoulder and a sort of haversack thing slung over the other, nearly passing out in the heat. By the time we landed and were taken out literally to a tented camp, I'd got the most ghastly attack of jippy tummy, was in complete agony, and spent half my time dashing from the camp bed across to the loos, which were awful. And the next morning I really thought I was going to die, but somehow I got into my clothes and we were put into a troop train. Fortunately, at the cabin we were in, there were two doctors that had actually been on the Orchides with us, so they knew us quite well. One of them said, "Bunty, what's wrong with you?" And I said, "I'm dead." And he got out some brandy, which I honestly think saved my life. It was almost instant relief, and I decided maybe I would live after all. And eventually we arrived in Cairo, and we were divided up then. Most of the WAF cipher officers were sent off to TME, which was Telecommunications Middle East, which was the big headquarters thing, and I knew they did mostly Typex machine ciphers, which I hated. And the rest of us, which were about four, I suppose, there was Annette, Carson, Anne Smith, the Canadian Ruth Johnson, and myself. And we were sent to 276 Wing, which was a Y Wing, of which we was very harsh and of which we knew nothing. And we were told it was so hush-hush that they wouldn't have us living in a mess anywhere in case we talked shop. Because the little bit of information you had yourself didn't mean much if that was divulged, but if you put it with another bit of the jigsaw, of another little bit, it meant rather a lot. And we were divided up again there. Annette and Anne were both touch typists, so they went to the Typex room. Ruth and myself were not, so we did book ciphers. Because it was so, as I say, it was so hush-hush, we weren't allowed to live in a mess, we were given squadron leaders living out rates, which we thought was absolute bliss, but told to find somewhere to go and live, which was a bit daunting at the age of 21. I'd never been out of England before, with the whole of Cairo, Heliopolis, spread before us. So we were sent, first of all, to the Heliopolis House Hotel, which was commonly known as Hell House, because practically everybody who went in there came out with jippy tummy. And so we were dumped at Hell House, and exactly who heard about it, I don't know. But 276 Wing was the first desert station, so it was just outside the perimeter of Heliopolis, which is really a suburb of Cairo. And Heliopolis airfield, the RAF airfield, was further in. And apparently several of the aircrew, I don't know if it was three or four of them, had rented a villa in Heliopolis, residential part. And then they were told they had to live on camp, so they had to give up their tenancy. And we took it on. And so the four of us rented a number of 11, I think it was, Sharia Ashmoon, which was known as Magnoon Manor. And Magnoon is, roughly speaking, Arabic for mad. So it was never known as anything but Magnoon Manor. And there we were for about a year. Quite suddenly, squadron living leaders living out paid never seemed to be enough to pay the rent and our taxes and our way of life. So we were always broke. We had to scrape the barrel month after month to pay the rent. But on the whole, it was gathered together somehow. During daylight hours, we actually walked to the building where the headquarters, the Y-Wing headquarters was, which I believe was being built. King Farouk was on the throne then, and his father, King Fuad, was having this museum built to house, I think, Tutankhamun's things that they took out, but it wasn't finished when the war started. So we, the RAF, or the Y-Wing in particular, had taken over this building in its half-finished state, which meant there was a huge unfinished auditorium in the middle, and there were offices all the way around the edge, which were occupied by ciphers, signals, obviously, and by a very learned lot of people who were mostly linguists. They were put into uniform to come overseas, because if they'd been taken prisoner and they were in civilian clothes, they'd have been shot as spies, whereas if they were in uniform, they were given prisoner of war status. But none of them knew how to wear their uniform. They hadn't the remotest idea when to salute, who to salute, or what to salute. They were the most rapshackle people in uniform you've ever seen. They were awfully nice and awfully clever, but not exactly smart. And I think one of the most embarrassing things that we had there was an ENSA trip from George Formby, who made these feeble and ghastly jokes in this auditorium, which went down like a lead balloon. I mean, I didn't like George Formby. Because these learned gentlemen had never heard of anything quite so silly. I mean, we were bad enough, but they were worse. It was agony. And we had our own little private jokes, because to get out of our office, we had to cross over what should have been the stage in its finished thing. And for some unknown reason, Anne, who was fairly tubby in those days, she used to finish about, because we weren't necessarily on the same watch. Ruth and I were, but the other two weren't. And if Anne was on, came off due to the same time as us, as we crossed the stage to get out of the building, she said, "Come on, Bunce, let's do our current bun act," which meant that we danced across the stage with our hands ridiculously sort of under our chin. And however tired you were and been on all night, you still did the current bun girl act across the stage. Social life in Cairo was tremendous. I mean, I make no excuses for you. We were much in demand. One was wined and dined and danced, well, every night of the week if you could get off duty long enough. It was either usually the Continental Roof Garden, and then somebody, and I still can't remember who, made me a member of a rather up-class club called Club de Chasse, and there you could dance and eat and drink all night if necessary. I became frightfully popular because I could get anyone in there on my pass, my membership pass. Ruth and I, as I said, worked together, and what basically the work was, we had, were rather erroneously called field stations, which had never seen a blade of grass. I mean, they were spies behind the enemy line, mostly, who reported on, obviously, troop movements. And they would send them in. It was not much more than a code. It was done on a one-time pad. There were certain words we had to remember by numbers, by heart. And there were other bits which you, if you got stuck, you could look them up. A great deal of it was extremely boring because it was wavelengths and things that meant absolutely nothing to us at all. Occasionally you got rather exciting things. I can remember when Sfax, because it was when the 8th Army was moving up the desert pretty quickly, Sfax and Sousse were falling. And I mean, I can remember deciphering that message. And it was really quite exciting, the whole thing. While we were there, our time off duty, I had a tame pilot who had his own little unit down at us in the canal zone at a place called El Fadan. And Ruth and I, it was not far from Ismailia, which is a very nice little town, and had a nice, the French club was lovely. And if we came off night duty and we weren't too exhausted, we used to hitchhike down to Ismailia on any open truck, anything that would stop for us. And then we stayed at the YWCA, which was again a lovely a little house, a big house in the middle of Ismailia. We'd either go to sleep off our night duty, and then get up in the evening, go for a swim at the French club, and then usually Dick and his squadron would come down and have dinner with us, or we'd go off dancing somewhere, and then totally illegally, one of his unit used to fly us back to Heliopolis to go on duty again. Well, very often we flew there in a Harvard, which only seats the pilot and one other. So what we did for that was, Ruth was taller than me, so she got in first in the passenger seat, and I sat on top of her. Fortunately, you weren't very long in the air, because I couldn't sit upright at all if you shut the lid. Anyway, that went on week after week after week. Made a nice change from Cara. And then she and I were going on leave. Her father was actually a bishop in Canada. And she very much wanted to go to the Holy Land. So I got my tame pilot,